This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Tony Cox. Michelle Martin is away. Coming up, We Need to Talk. That's the title of a documentary focused on the toughest conversations between mothers and their adolescent daughters, especially those in single-parent households. But first, as students return to school, we'll focus on the Obama administration's Race to the Top education competition. It's time for the winning states and the District of Columbia to put their plans to work. Each has won tens of millions, some hundreds of millions of dollars to implement innovative ideas that the government says will directly impact more than 13 million students and almost 1 million teachers. Here's President Obama.
Last year, we set aside more than $4 billion to improve our schools, one of the largest investments in reform in our nation's history. But we didn't just hand this money out to states that wanted it. We challenged them to compete for it. And it's the competitive nature of this initiative that we believe helps make it so effective. We laid out a few key criteria and said, if you meet these tests, we'll reward you by helping you reform your schools.
The key criteria Mr. Obama referred to includes better preparing students for college and jobs, building systems that track student growth, recruiting, training, and rewarding effective teachers and principals, and revamping the lowest performing schools. 46 total states plus the District of Columbia applied for phases 1 and 2 of the Race to the Top competition. In phase 1, Delaware and Tennessee received a combined $600 million. Now we are in phase 2 with 9 states and the district as the winners of nearly $3.4 billion to spend on improving their schools. Now that funds are coming, what exactly will be done with those billions, and will these programs really work? In a moment, we'll be joined by two people who have a strong interest in Race to the Top, Deborah Gist, the Department of Education Commissioner for Rhode Island, which is among the winning states, and Andy Ford, Vice President of the American Federation of Teachers Union and President of the Florida Education Association, Florida also one of the winners as well. But let's begin with journalist Degari Ahrens of Education Week magazine. He is here in our Washington, D.C. studios. Takari, nice to have you. It's Dakari, isn't
Dakari,
it?
Yes.
All right, I apologize for getting that wrong. Let's start with this. Were there common denominations, common denominators, let's say, in terms of the winning plans? Were teachers or teachers' unions especially significant in the decision-making?
Well, certainly there are a number of common denominators. As a result of the Race to the Top competition, over the past year, a number of states have changed their laws, for example, around teacher evaluation. Tennessee, which won in the first round, and other states, you know, such as Rhode Island, and have come and focused on, you know, adding student performance to how teachers are evaluated. Traditionally, teachers are evaluated based on an observation in the classroom, but there has been a push by the Obama administration and others to include student test scores and other items into how teachers are evaluated and making sure they are actually evaluated annually. And that's one of the things that we've seen.
In describing this, Dakari, is it a situation in which the states began to tailor their programs and their proposed programs to what they thought the federal government wanted, or was it a situation in which the federal government reached out across the country and said, okay, you're doing it right in Tennessee, you're doing it right in Delaware, we'll give you the money?
Well, the states absolutely went. They looked at the criteria. There's 500 points that were available, and the department put out a guideline that shows you each of the categories and how much it was worth. And states certainly went out. Governors, state education commissioners like Deborah Gist, who will be joining us later, went out immediately and said, hey, we need to change our laws. We want to be competitive for this money. And not only do we want to be competitive for this money, but we believe this is the right thing to do for our education system.
Now, one of the things that's been written about this so far is that the bulk of the states that received the money are all located east of the Mississippi. Coincidence or something more than that?
Well, the department would tell you it's a coincidence, and certainly there were a lot of people who looked at states such as Colorado and Louisiana, which both had changed a number of their laws, for example, around teacher evaluation and paying teachers in part based on their performance, and were concerned that those states were not selected. But Education Secretary Arne Duncan said, you know, I love what those states are doing, love what California was doing. Unfortunate that we weren't able to give them money, but we went according to the ranking. But there's a lot of people who are questioning why so many states along the East Coast received the
money. Got the money. Here's one state that got a hefty chunk of money, as reported from local news station WPRI.
Rhode Island is in. It means Rhode Island could get up to $75 million in federal money for education reforms. Also, among the winners, Massachusetts, Florida, Georgia, Hawaii, Maryland, New York, North Carolina, Ohio, and Washington, D.C.
Now let's bring in Rhode Island Education Commissioner Deborah Gist. Also with us, Andy Ford, a vice president of the union known as the American Federation of Teachers, who also heads up the Florida Education Association, Florida being one of the Race to the Top winners as well, reaping about $700 million for its education reform plans. Commissioner Andy, nice to have both of you.
Hi, Tony. Thank you.
Hello. Glad to be here.
Well, congratulations, I suppose, would be the first thing to say to the both of you. Commissioner, what do you think was the turning point, if there was such a thing, for your state in winning this money?
You know, we are so excited about this and really ready to put these funds to good use here in our state. And I think that for us, we felt really, really confident about our plan in both the first round and in the second round. But it was truly in that second round where everything came together for us. Our state really mobilized around not just this application, but really the plan itself. And I think the fact that we had Rhode Island Federation of Teachers and Health Professionals, which is the district that represents our biggest city, the union that represents the teachers in our biggest cities, was a big part of this. We had members of the business community and the nonprofit community and teachers and principals and superintendents. And I think it was really the way everyone came together which helped us to improve the quality of our proposal, but also really we were able to demonstrate that this was a statewide effort.
Andy Ford, I'm going to ask you in a moment about the union involvement because that's a key part of this. But before we do, I want to ask you this question because how does Race to the Top differ substantially and substantively from, let's say, No Child Left Behind?
Well, it moves us from a formula-driven program to a competitive grant process, which does change the whole landscape. And allows school districts and states to take a look at obtaining funds in a different way. So it's majorly different in terms of the way the funding is flowing.
Is there accountability that you will have, both of you, in terms of how the money is spent and how you would have to let the government know how you spent the money? Andy, you first on that.
We have to go through the grant process and make sure that the locals, when they bargain changes to the contract and implement the grant, that we're complying with the requirements of the federal government, and there's a monitoring program where each year you have to report what was accomplished with the funds.
Commissioner, is that the same for your state, or does the accountability differ from state to state?
Oh, no, it's certainly the same. I mean, I think what the U.S. Department of Education wants to see is whether or not each state is following the plan that they put into place, whether or not they're using the funds in the ways that they described that they would. And certainly we will be held accountable to that. And we've already begun conversations with the Department of Education to get all of that solidified.
What do you plan to do specifically with the money in Rhode Island?
Well, the funding in Rhode Island is going to we understand deeply that this is a one-time investment. And so we see this as our opportunity to move from the education system that we have today to the one we all envision. And our goal is nothing short of having the best public schools in the country. And so our investment, the primary area in which we're investing these funds is in professional development for our educators. And this includes obviously our teachers, but also school leaders and district leaders. And it's support for our educators in everything from engaging them deeply in the development of curriculum and the use of that curriculum, as well as a strong understanding of our standards and helping us to transition to the common state standards where all the states have come together around a set of standards. And also in the use of data and how to use information about how our students are doing to make sure that we're ensuring that every single child in our school is achieving at their greatest capacity.
That's one of the controversial issues in terms of providing or publicizing information about what is going on in the schools. And I want to follow that up with you, Andy. But before you answer that question, if I'm a parent in Florida, what am I going to see differently, and how soon am I going to see that difference with regard to how you are educating my child?
Well, I think some of the things that you'll see is that the fact the school moving from individual teachers with individual students to a team concept where you're taking a look at the delivery of instruction from a student's point of view and trying to revamp the whole curriculum to make sure that we're hitting on all the targets, because some of our goals within the Race to the Top are obviously focusing on our lowest performing schools. But our overall goal is to close the achievement gap between majority and minority students and reduce our dropout rate, as well as taking a look at the teacher evaluation system.
If I'm a teacher in Florida, am I worried about my job now as a result of this?
Well, you shouldn't be worried about your job as a result of this. Our economy is a different situation, and we do have some obstacles in terms of general funding of public schools in the state of Florida to deal with. But Race to the Top is a supplement to the state's budget for a specific purpose, and mainly it is focused on teacher evaluation systems and compensation.
Now, the AFT, your union, supported the evaluation system, as I understand it, while the NEA, the National Education Association, did not. Is that correct, Andy?
There are differences. Florida is a merged state, so we're affiliated with both the National Education Association and the American Federation of Teachers. And they do have differing opinions on subjects at times. But basically, the AFT embraced the concept of putting money behind something that we've tried to deal with for a very long time, and that's the teacher evaluation system, and trying to make it more data-driven and research-based in order to be able to identify teachers who are doing an outstanding job and to assist those who are not.
Dakari, we're going to talk more about this, but we're going to take a break first, and we'll continue our conversation about the Race to the Top education program in just a few moments. Our guests are Dakari Ahrens of Education Week, Andy Ford of the American Federation of Teachers, and Rhode Island Department of Elementary and Secondary Education Commissioner Deborah Gist. Stay with us on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Tony Cox. Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Tony Cox. Michelle Martin is away. Coming up, many Gulf Coast residents have returned to their old neighborhoods in the 5 years since Katrina, but a number of reports suggest that in New Orleans, programs aren't adequately supporting African Americans who also want to come home. More on that in a moment. But first, we continue now with our conversation about the Obama administration's Race to the Top education program. 46 states applied for this two-round competition, which offered over $4 billion in grants for school reform. We are in phase two of the competition now, where 9 states and the District of Columbia are winners. Education Week writer Dakari Ahrens joins us in our Washington, D.C. studios. We are also joined by Rhode Island Department of Education Commissioner Deborah Gist and American Federation of Teachers Vice President Andy Ford. Before the break, we want to talk about this teacher added evaluation. Dakari, it's been very controversial, particularly in California with the publication of the names of these school teachers. Is it as controversial elsewhere in the country?
Absolutely. The Los Angeles Times recently published a list of the what we would call the value-added scores of teachers. And what that means, rather than looking at the proficiency or how well students do each year, we're looking at the growth of students over time. And there's a lot of debate in the education policy community among researchers about the value of this information and whether it really tells us what we need to know about student performance and whether we can really measure individual teachers based on it.
Andy, I want to ask you about it, but by way of full disclosure, let me say now that my own daughter is a school teacher in the LA Unified School District who was one of those people whose effectiveness was rated and published. She did well, so I was happy for that. But yet, it is something that people in California and elsewhere are talking about. As a union, Andy, where do you stand on this?
Well, I think we're taking part of the decision-making process about teacher evaluations, and we're publishing only part of the answer. It's not an overall comparison. And then you even have the people who have developed some of these formulas questioning whether the data could be actually used for the purpose that we're trying to use it for. I think a better approach would be to actually develop an evaluation instrument that you knew was effective and that was research-based and that the results were reliable. Because everything I've seen about what took place in Los Angeles, there's questions on whether the data was actually even reliable.
Commissioner Guest, two points are raised here in terms of what we're talking about. One is the efficacy of the evaluation itself, whether it is complete or not complete. And secondly, whether or not that information should be made public and who is entitled to know what that information is. What's your view on it, and how does your school system operate with regard to this?
Well, first of all, in order to use a value-added model, you have to have good data and you have to have a strong model. And so we actually are exploring right now whether or not, and if so, how we will use that kind of information, whether it's value added or what's called a growth model or some sort of way for us to be able to take a look at information that we have around student performance on our standardized test scores. But what I think is really important is that this is just one piece of information, and it is one piece of information that should be a part of an evaluation that is comprehensive. And what we're doing in our state right now is developing an overall system that is primarily intended to help our educators grow and develop as professionals. That's the purpose of it. And we have over 100 educators. They've been working all summer long on our evaluation system. And we're working very, very closely with our teachers and our teachers' union, with the Rhode Island, our affiliate of the AFT in particular, have been deeply, deeply involved in this work.
My final question is this, and a brief answer from all three of you would be very much appreciated. Is it your sense that we are moving into a new era in which teachers can and should expect to be evaluated and to have that evaluation made public in one form or another? Dakar, you first.
I think that remains to be seen, but after the publication of this information by the LA Times, there certainly has been a lot of interest, I know, among other education reporters in the country in finding out this type of information, and I know that many researchers have wanted access to this kind of information to really study whether teachers are effective.
Commissioner Gist.
Well, that's a two-part question. I would say that with evaluation, absolutely, because our educators deserve to have good information that helps them to grow and develop as professionals. In terms of making that information public, I think that's a much more complicated question, and I think it has to be handled very, very carefully. And I'm not comfortable with sort of this broad, let's just publish this test score data. But we do need to make sure that families have information about the quality of their schools.
Andy Ford, the last word to you.
I think everybody needs to be concerned about making sure that the teacher that's in the classroom is as effective as you can find. But the overuse and reliance on test scores has some negative consequences that I hope everybody would pay attention to. It does cause you to narrow the curriculum and to teach to the test. A full comprehensive evaluation that involved multiple measures, I think, would be a better service to the public.
Dakari Ahrens is a writer for Education Week. He joined us here in our Washington studios. We also heard from Andy Ford. He is the vice president of the American Federation of Teachers and the president of the Florida Education Association. He joined us from member station WFSU in Tallahassee. We also spoke with Deborah Gist, Rhode Island Department of Elementary and Secondary Education commissioner. She was with us from member station WRNI in Providence, Rhode Island. The three of you, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tony.
Thank you.
They say it takes a village to raise a child, but maybe you just need a few moms in your corner. We visit each week with a diverse group of parents for their common sense and savvy parenting advice. In the documentary, We Need to Talk, A Message to Our Daughters, a dozen or so women talk about their first loves, their lives, and most pointedly, what they wish they had known as young girls themselves.
When you're giving up something that is the most precious thing that you can give, when you really could, if you had a real relationship, they would coach you into saying, oh, okay, well, maybe that's not the wisest choice. But when we both are in something that we have no knowledge of, then you'll do whatever because everybody else is doing it. So sex, yes. Other things, drinking. I mean, the crowd that I hung out with, we drank every day.
Drinking and sex are just two of the issues filmmaker Jenks Morton explored in this documentary. He has been barnstorming the East Coast with his film, playing to theaters of women who are bringing their daughters, then talking about what and how to apply the advice to their own lives. And he says the results have been deeply touching and potentially life-saving. And Jenks Morton joins us now in our studios. Also with us from Chicago member station WBEZ is Dr. Carl Bell, professor of psychiatry and public health at the University of Illinois. Dr. Bell, also the president of a comprehensive community mental health center located on Chicago's South Side. And with us in studio, Danny Tucker and Diane Jackson, two mothers of adolescent daughters. Hi, everybody.
Hi.
Hello.
This is quite something to talk about. Let me begin with you, Jenks. Where did the idea for We Need to Talk come from?
It's actually a progression from the work that I've been doing over a number of years. And thank you for having me. The movie from last year was called Men to Boys, and basically it's 101 things that every boy of color should know. But with women, they're slightly more complex, so I can't give bullet points, staccato, expletives around what you need to know to become an ascent to proper manhood. So with women, it became more reflective and refractive of a series of life choices. It's more relational. It's more broad stroke than it is. But it's actually just a progression of the work that I've been doing for years.
Some people would call this the talk, right? Ooh. Some people would call this the talk. And Diane, you and your daughter saw this film, right?
Correct.
How old is she for the
first She's 16.
Part? 16, okay.
She'll be 17 tomorrow.
What was her reaction? I'm interested in hers, then I want to hear yours as well.
She was astounded that there were other people like what she's going through at age 16. The fact that they had the same story, even though she's so young, as to just boys and love, her thinking she's in love and the end result, as to how can you get over that. How can you get through it? But you can, because other women are going through it, have gone through it.
You know, as I watched it, I was wondering, is this designed for the parents to help them figure out a way to talk to their kids, or is it for the kids? And then how would you get a kid to sit and listen to some of what was said? Do you understand what I'm saying?
It's for both. It's definitely for the parents so they can educate and talk to their daughters so that they understand what they're going through is not something new. And it's definitely for all children. It's for all teens, all children, so they can see that your walk is not in vain, that you can learn something from somebody else. So it definitely has an impact on both.
Danny, what was your take on it?
I just saw it, and I can't, first of all, excellent job. I mean, it's long overdue. I talk to my 13-year-old all the time, but I was like a lot of these women, especially Stephanie. You know, grew up in a two-parent home where no one did talk. It was taboo to talk. You know, it was mom's business. It was grandma's business. So this is groundbreaking. I think it's just long overdue. I can't wait to get it and show it to my daughter. I mean, we already talk, because the bottom line, if you don't talk to him, Lil Wayne's going to talk to him. So, I mean, really, somebody's going to talk to him. I love New York. Somebody's going to talk to him. So the point is, who's going to talk and what's going to be said? And I like what he did, because what was said needed to be said. It was from personal experience. I'm anxious for part two. Okay, really, because I think you need to talk to a lot of the young women who didn't have the abortions and who have, you know, all the kids and the four daddies. I think that's what should be, you know, our next step.
Well, let's listen to a clip for the audience who hasn't had a chance to see this film yet. Here's a clip from it.
I myself, as I've worked with men and boys for years, I didn't know. I just did not know that at such a tender and young age, such complex and integral thoughts going on in a young girl's mind, that if you're not there to protect her from, there's a world of wolves out there waiting to exploit and destroy them.
That was you, Jenks, and I want to bring Dr. Bell in just a moment. But it seemed to me, to be honest with you about it, that there was this mixture of talking to your daughter about sex and relationship and love and commitment, but it was coupled with this religious theme that the way to avoid that was to go to church, if I can put it so crassly.
Well,
is that
not the take that I would probably put on that segment that we just listened to. When I say that I didn't know, there's another arc inside the film, and this is what I really believe is the major arc of what's going on. Yes, mothers have to share their life experience with their daughters. They have to give these resources in order to get this, so that the girls can make informed choices. But there's a special role that a father has with his daughter. And that's what I'm talking to there, that there's certain things that a father will give a daughter to protect her from little Wayne, that he will give her to validate and acknowledge and approve of her in a way that's complementary to the mother that leads to the best outcomes for young girls. Now, the arc in there for some of the women around religion, yes, that's the pathway. But the arc of what I'm describing through that segment is to talk about fathers. I'm telling you, you need to step up and engage in your daughter's life in a very specific way in order to protect them from some of the things that are waiting for them if you don't.
Well, I'm a father, too, of two daughters, as a matter of fact. And sometimes they listen to me and sometimes they don't, if you just want to be honest about it. Dr. Bell, what's your take on the best way and the most effective way to communicate with our young people about, around this very important topic?
Well, I think it's important to understand child development. The brain develops from bottom up and from inside out, and so the first parts of the brain that are developed are the fight, flight, and freeze parts of the brain. Those thinking, judgment, wisdom parts of the brain don't fully develop to 26. And as a result, some teenagers will actually get in situations, have bad outcomes, and because their ability and capacity to think, because their brains haven't fully formed, some teenagers can't even learn from their own experiences. And so all of the research is pretty clear that if you can keep kids safe by, as we've already heard, protecting them, by having a warm, nurturing relationship with them, you can protect them from being all gasoline, no brakes and no steering wheel.
You talk about in an article that you wrote for the Journal of American, the Journal of American Medical Association, some very clinical kinds of terms. Is it your point that there are things that you just cannot really do until a child reaches a certain age? You talked about this, I think it's called nursing family relationship. Is that something that can make a difference?
There's the Obama administration in healthcare reform recently let $15 billion to do a prevention program of home visitation that showed there's a lot of strong research that if you go into the homes and teach teen mothers how to nurture, form strong bonds and attachment with young infants, those infants grow up with something called affect regulation, which essentially is emotional control. They have some brakes, some steering wheel. Even with that, teenagers, because they're teenagers, are rambunctious. Again, it's all fight, flight, and freeze with no steering wheel and no brakes, to not be technical about it. So all of the HIV prevention, all of the violence prevention, all of the drug abuse prevention research out there says that, you know, teenagers are really hard because they're all this gasoline without brakes. But if, because they don't have brakes and steering wheels, what you need is a village around them that has eyes on that child at all times. What you need are children who have some early brakes and steering wheel, and you need parents who have good, strong relationships, which I think is the value of the film, and you have parents who understand their need to be those children's brakes and steering wheel, because children are children and they're not little adults.
That's true. We're going to continue the conversation. There's a lot to get at, and there's five of us actually, and we're going to try to get as many different points of view in as possible. But let me come to the two moms that are at the table. Danny, it's one thing we've heard from the clinical point of view. We've also heard from the filmmaker, and we've seen in the film sort of the religious component that is a part of this. As a mother, what do you think is most effective for you?
Sharing your personal experience, not to take away from what the doctor said. You need to have that. You got the mom and the dad, or, you know, the nurturing. But where we lost in the 70s with our parents and with their parents, they don't share their personal experience. There's nothing like being able to share with your daughter what you went through. You mm-hmm. understand? My daughter's looking at me. You know, she may like Michelle Obama. She may like her grandmother, but she's looking at me.
All right, hold that thought, because we want to continue this conversation mm-hmm. after the break. We're talking with psychiatrist Dr. Carl Bell here in our studios, Danny Tucker, Diane Jackson, and the We Need to Talk documentary filmmaker, Jenks Morton. I'm Tony Koch. We'll be back. Stay with us. This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Tony Cox. Michelle Martin is away. Coming up, a bumpy road home for African Americans looking to return to New Orleans during the recovery from Hurricane Katrina. But first, we continue now with our conversation about the new documentary, We Need to Talk, a guide for tough talks with your teenage daughters. Our guests are filmmaker Jenks Morton, also with us psychiatrist Dr. Carl Bell, and parents Diane Jackson and Danny Tucker, also with us. Before the break, Danny, you were making a point.
Oh, yeah. Like I said, as a mom, my biggest thing with my daughter is to share my personal experiences. You got to let her know the mistakes I made, what I learned from them, and hoping that will help her as she faces similar situations.
Well, what about that, Diane, what your experience is? Because I know sometimes kids are like, you know, well, that's what happened to you.
Right.
That was back then, you know, when dinosaurs roamed the earth. This is new stuff now. We have a new way of dealing with things.
Well, I agree with Danny. You have to be open. You're right. Our parents were kind of closed mouth about their past. And I have two girls. I have a 17-year-old and a 14-year-old. And I'm a parent. I'm going to be a grandmother soon. My daughter is pregnant. And the fact that the movie helped us see things differently. And also allowed her to talk to her friends and her friends. And it's just spreading the word that, and even for me and my girlfriends and my peers to say, hey, we have to start speaking to our daughters. We have to let them know. Even parents of boys, tell your boys how this is affecting these girls. And so we can make a difference in educating and being open and dealing with those demons and not hiding the past and dealing with our wounds. We can make a difference.
Well, Jenks, let me play devil's advocate with you for a moment, if I will, about the film. Because it focused on the girls and their dealing with it. And there is a school of thought that too much of the responsibility and the pressure for avoiding teenage pregnancy falls on the girls. And your film doesn't really talk with or about the guys very much. Why was that?
Well, this is the first time that I've walked in that lane or that space of working with women. I've done work with men and boys for years, so I know that one. But think of this as a conversation starter. I'm not going to be perfect. It's not going to cover. This movie, even as short as it is as complex as part of a woman. There are so many avenues that you can go through to explore this. And yes, that is one. But I'm going to keep driving the point back to this, that if I have two parents helping a child navigate to adulthood, then I'm not having the conversation about the boys. If these young girls knew how valuable and precious and how special they were, and they have been protected and nurtured in the proper ways, then I don't have to worry about the boys because the boys are not interested. Little Wayne is a joke. He's not going to take away from these girls what we see is happening. So,
Dr. Bell, my last question for you is this, because our time is running short. Can a film be effective in sending a message like this?
A film can get the fire started. The difficulty, if you're going to change behavior, you have to have a life makeover. You have to be proactive. You've got to be preventive in your approach. You've got to start actually pre-infancy, when the child is in utero. You've got to make sure that there's a good bond and attachment and capacity for connectedness, which starts at infancy. There has to be good relationships between parent and child. That parent has to have social skills, social and emotional skills. That parent has to show emotional control to teach their child emotional control. That parent has to keep eyes on that child.
Well, let me stop you there only because the clock is saying we have to end it. But your point is well taken. You did have, and I think the audience should know this, some outstanding, very poignant stories from the women who you were able to get in there. Mm-hmm. And if anybody could tell the story, they could definitely do
Absolutely.
It. You could feel it. And thank you for coming in and sharing with us. The name of the film is We Need to Talk, and I suppose that's true. We need to talk. Joining us, psychiatrist Dr. Carl Bell. Also with us here, Danny Tucker and Diane Jackson, both mothers, and the filmmaker of We Need to Talk, Jenks Morton. Again, thank you all for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
And now we turn to our weekly conversation on personal finance. Record low mortgage interest rates have created another refinancing boom. Right now, homeowners can lock in interest rates as low as 4.25% for a standard 30-year fixed mortgage. According to the Mortgage Bankers Association, home loan refinancing activity jumped more than 26% as of August 20th, reaching its highest level in 15 months. But finance experts are saying not everyone who can refinance should refinance, and not everyone who should can. Here to explain some of the issues for us is Tell Me More's money coach Alvin Hall. He joins us from NPR's New York Bureau. Welcome, Alvin.
Hello, Tony.
Alvin, who should look to take advantage of these rates?
Anyone who has a high interest mortgage, anything above 5.5%, should look at taking advantage of these new low rates. It would reduce their monthly payments substantially. And that is the key thing, locking in this low rate for as long a period as you can.
We mentioned that not everyone who should refinance can refinance. So which homeowners want to refinance but cannot, and why not?
There are several things that are going on these days. First of all, when people apply for a refinancing of their home, they need to expect that in the current economic climate, there's going to be a 100% audit of their application. That means if there's anything wrong, if there's weakness in the credit scores, or that they're not putting up enough money, they don't have enough money to do it, then the bank is likely to say no and turn them down. And they'll discover that they'll be turned down again and again as they go from one place to another. So the whole landscape has changed, partly due to reforms brought about by the economic crisis that we're in, and also problems brought about by the fact that a lot of people are unemployed or have seen their salaries become either frozen or stagnant over the past couple of years.
Alvin, many homeowners with adjustable rate mortgages are looking for something more stable. Is refinancing a good option for them, or, and this seems contrary to the wisdom of the day, just stay with the adjustable rate that you already have?
Oh, no, if you have an adjustable rate mortgage and you can lock in a fixed rate at this level, lock it in now. Remember, adjustable rates have those teaser rates up front. But then, as interest rates go up, they will move up. No one can tell what's going to happen in the future. And clearly, there's the expectation that inflation will enter the economy at some point and interest rates will go up. If you can lock in a low rate now, it's the time to do it.
With the hope for recovery still coming along very, very slowly, is buying a home still the best purchase slash investment that you can make today?
That's up for grabs. People are now saying that buying a home is no longer the type of investment it used to be, that people will no longer be able to see house prices rise at that spectacular level that they've always been. But, you know, conventional wisdom for years was that buying a house was not an investment. Buying a house was a form of enforced savings. What you would be doing, you would be putting your money into the house, and hopefully the value would be going up at a nice rate so that when you retired and you downsized, you'd be able to pull some money out of it to fund your retirement. People are saying that even as a savings vehicle, people will no longer be able to expect the type of returns they have in the past. So this makes a strong argument, I believe, for diversification, that people should still own property but not view it as a fail-safe investment, that because they only have so much land, they can't build but so many houses, therefore there'll always be demand. That logic is thrown out of the window these days. So diversify. Have some money in property, some money in stocks and bonds, some money in savings in the form of cash. Diversify your holdings.
So nothing is as it was. And talking again about refinancing, Alvin, what do you think homeowners who are stuck with low home values and maybe shaky credit as well, what can they do? Or are they stuck?
They are in the most difficult position. Today, banks are looking at loan-to-value ratios of 75-80%. That means you have to have 20% down. Some of you be even being more conservative. They're looking at 70 and 65% loan-to-value ratios. If you have bad credit, the property has gone down, you are going to have to appeal to the bank or try to get involved in one of those programs that the Obama administration has put out. But those are not likely to be very successful either, according to news reports.
Final thing is this. With interest rates being low, there is not necessarily, is there, Alvin, a connection between that and the housing prices?
No. Interest rates being low often can have the effect of making house prices go up by creating demand. But because of the recent drop in house prices, a lot of them are still low, and people expect them to be lower. So you have all of these people who are out there basically scavenging, trying to buy property at the lowest point and bidding it down, 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 because they want to lock in the smallest amount of mortgage at the lowest interest rate they can. Right now, there seems to be no real connection between interest rates and housing prices.
Really quickly, our time is running short. 15 years versus 30-year fixed, which is the best?
Well, I think for most people, a 15-year fix is what they should look at. However, if you can't afford the payments on a 15-year fix and you want the comfort of knowing you can afford those payments over the longest period of time, go for the 30. It's all about comfort level and your certainty that you can make those mortgage payments through good times and bad times like these.
Alvin Hall is an expert in personal finance. He joined us from our New York Bureau. Alvin, thank you very much.
You're most welcome.
Let's turn next to housing in New Orleans. 5 years after Hurricane Katrina, there are several stories of return and renewal. In his remarks from the Crescent City on Sunday, President Obama praised those residents who have come back to rebuild their neighborhoods.
I don't have to tell you that there's still too many vacant and overgrown lots. There's still too many students attending classes in trailers. There's still too many people unable to find work. And there's still too many New Orleans folks who haven't been able to come home. So while an incredible amount of progress has been made, on this fifth anniversary, I wanted to come here and tell the people of this city directly. My administration is going to stand with you and fight alongside you until the job is done, until New Orleans is all the way back, all the way.
But not everyone will have the opportunity to make it back home. A recent poll by the Kaiser Family Foundation found that while 7 in 10 New Orleans residents say the rebuilding effort is going in the right direction, African Americans are more than twice as likely as whites to say that they have not yet recovered from Hurricane Katrina. To get a better understanding of the remaining challenges to recovery, we are joined now by James Perry. He is the executive director of the Greater New Orleans Fair Housing Action Center, and he joins us from New Orleans. Welcome.
Hey, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Mr. Perry, earlier this month, a federal judge ruled that the Road Home Program, a federally funded grant program established by the state of Louisiana, had a formula for calculating grants that discriminated against black homeowners. Tell us about that.
Sure. For many African-American homeowners, the Road Home Program has ended up as a road to nowhere. The program relied on property values to determine how much money people got to rebuild their homes. But unfortunately, what we found is that property values in African-American neighborhoods were so low that sometimes people did not get enough money to cover the cost of rebuilding. While if you looked at white neighborhoods in New Orleans, oftentimes, or white census tracts, oftentimes what you found was that the values were high enough to cover the actual cost of rebuilding. And so the end result was that African-American homeowners, by and large, got some money, but not enough money to get back into their homes.
Is this discrepancy in lending about race, or is it about the difference in the value of the property?
Well, you know, we brought this claim under the Federal Fair Housing Act, and one of the important things to note about that law is that it doesn't require you to prove that any discriminatory effect is intentional. And I don't think that the folks designing this program intended to discriminate against people based on their race. But the fact is that the effect has been discriminatory. African-American neighborhoods simply have not been able to fully rebuild. And so I would say that the effect is a racialized effect. And so it doesn't matter what the intent was, but I do think the fundamental issue is that we all want to see New Orleans rebuilt in an equitable way. And if that's true, then we have to fix this formula.
So what does that mean for the Ninth Ward then? Is it dead forever?
Well, you know, one of the most telling signs of or the way that this that the lawsuit and that the judge's opinion reveals itself when you come to the city is that if you drive through the Lower Ninth Ward, you don't see homes, you don't see families. Instead, what you see are vacant fields, oftentimes overgrown, and occasionally you'll see a set of stairs that lead to nowhere because a home used to be there. And the families wanted to rebuild most of the time, wanted to move back to the lower Ninth Ward, but going through this grant program, were not able to get enough money to rebuild their homes. And so the poster child of our recovery, the lower Ninth Ward, is not back yet. It's very simple.
Now, those homes were in bad shape before Katrina, were they not?
Well, some were and some were not. You know, the lower Ninth Ward was a low and middle income community. And of course, there were homes just like any community that were in good shape and homes that weren't. But here's the bottom line. We are trying to rebuild a city and rebuild a community. And what we have so far has not gotten us to that goal.
Here's a two part question for you. First part. Could the government or the private sector or the two in tandem do something to bring the lower Ninth Ward back in the way that other parts of New Orleans have been helped? And number two, the second part to that question is, do you think that will ever happen?
Well, that's a great question. And I think that this is a unique circumstance where government's responsibility comes into direct play. Here's the fundamental thing is that the way that the lower Ninth Ward and the rest of the city is destroyed is not because Katrina hits the city, but it's because the federal levees were poorly maintained and weren't properly taken care of. And as a result, this was a man-made, in fact, government-made disaster. Had the government been on its job, there would have been no disaster. The lower Ninth Ward likely would have been spared. And so there's an argument that since the government failed and caused the disaster, then perhaps it's government's obligation to right the wrong, to correct the problem. And it's part of the reason that George Bush came to New Orleans and stood in our city and said that he was going to rebuild New Orleans and make it an even better city than it was before. So now this problem falls squarely on President Obama's shoulders. For instance, the flaw in this Road Home program, which is a federally funded and created program, is a mistake made by George Bush, but that can be remedied by President Obama. And he hasn't remedied it yet. And so when it comes to the second part of your question, that's what's at issue right now is the president seeing this ruling from a federal judge saying that this federal program is discriminatory? Is he going to take the steps to remedy this program? And that's what we don't know the answer to yet. A lot of us held our breath on Sunday as he spoke to New Orleanians and hoped that he would announce a fix to the Road Home program. He did not.
James Perry is the executive director of the Greater New Orleans Fair Housing Center. He joined us from member station WWNO in New Orleans. James, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
That's our program for today. I'm Tony Cox, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.